And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Shamrock. I'm Pete Sampson, joined as always by my host, Matt Fortuna, who is neither a narcissist nor should be slapped. We'll get into some of those comments today. Got Notre Dame State of the Program running on Monday. I had a story last week sort of on advice for Marcus Freeman from other coaches who were first-time head coaches at the Power 5 level. We can get into that. But Matt, I mean, your story with Bruce and Brody, who is our LSU writer, who's we've gifted the Brian Kelly experience to in the last 6 months. Man, that was something. I was trying to think of like what the best Notre Dame head coach feud was. I think you had to go back to like Charlie Weiss and Pete Carroll and some snarky comments on Weiss's way out of town. But and maybe Brian Kelly and Derek Mason play fighting in a press conference after a game. But that was about it. Nothing quite at the Saban Jimbo level.
Look into Pete Sampson's history of reporting, listeners. Look into how he does his business and how he gets his sources. Okay. That's all I'll say about that. Do some digging.
Oh my goodness. Jimbo.
Sliced bread has set the world ablaze. It wasn't just our friend Lou Nanny. It was Nick Saban. It was everyone who's apparently run away with this story and turned it into, in my opinion, one of the most fascinating offseason stories I think we've ever had. I mean, probably like in the 60s and 70s when, you know, the media wasn't what it was now. There were coaches who weren't afraid to tell you how they really felt about each other publicly. But man, like two guys, two national championship winners who worked together and who as recently as, you know, was it 4 years ago, I'm standing outside the Alabama locker room after they win it all and who's waiting there for an hour to say congratulations, Nick, Jimbo Fisher. Like these guys were... They've been in some battles together and now they're battling each other. And some of those accusations that are going back and forth. I mean, you could take this a number of different directions, but I was fascinated by the entire episode. I mean, which, you know, is only going to get better next week when they all gather in Destin, Florida for SEC spring meetings. And Brian Kelly is going to be there thinking, what the hell did I get myself into?
I thought Clark Lee is going to be there wondering.
Clark Lee, Lane Kiffin. I mean,
Mike Leach.
Is something else. I mean, I was surprised Nick Saban never speaks or says anything publicly without a purpose or without some calculation behind it. And I think a lot of the times when he complains about something publicly, that's more of a like, okay, do you want to do this? Cause I'll do it and I'll do it better than all of you. And you're all going to hate me for it after, whether it's hurry up, no huddle offense or what have you. But for him to name names like that was very out of character for him. It makes you wonder if maybe he's a little more like Dabo Swinney than he lets on publicly as far as how he feels about the current state of affairs and how much longer he's going to keep doing this. But Jimbo Fisher, like as much as I appreciate the content machine that he's provided all of us by calling an impromptu press conference and basically saying God does his business dirty and, you know, he needs to be slapped and yada, 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 you know, you're basically daring all of us to look into how you got those classes at LSU, Jimbo, because if you want to go down Nick Saban's recruiting history, that means going down Jimbo Fisher's recruiting history. And there was another TV report that came out last night from a San Antonio station where Jimbo just basically starts accusing the TV interviewer of making stuff up. And I don't think the reporter had any idea what he was even talking about, but it's going to be interesting next week because, you know, unlike most spring meetings, there's a podium there. There's Paul Feinbaum. There are scheduled public appearances that these coaches need to make on behalf of the SEC. And as much as we've heard Greg Sankey is sort of privately told these guys to shut up and be nice to each other publicly, they're all going to get asked about it. And you know, some of them, Lane Kiffin among them, probably won't be able to keep their thoughts to themselves.
once the microphone or the red light is on. So
I think he can't wait to give his thoughts on the matter.
I want to hear Brian Kelly's thoughts too on this.
I think, yeah, Brian Kelly, it's made a joke last week. Like, you know, Brian Kelly talked about he wanted to coach in the AL East and he is in fact coaching in the WWE. Like that's it. The SEC is just absolutely insane. And I'm in it, but I'm already looking ahead to like, all right, October 8th, I'm going to be in Vegas. Like, can I still watch Alabama A&M? Like, are there going to be conflicting kickoff times? Like, could we go?
I don't think game day is going to be in Vegas for Notre Dame BYU after.
No, I don't think so. I will be there. That's no problem. But yeah.
And you better put a hell of a lot of money on whatever the spread is for Alabama if you're there, because
it's pretty much Alabama minus anything for that one. It's just fascinating to watch how maybe I should have called Jimbo Fisher for my first time head coaches at the Power Five level story. Maybe he would have some advice for Marcus Freeman on how to comport yourself as a first time head coach. But
he won a national championship on, like, other than Bob Stoops, anyone else you talked to for that story?
Well, I mean, Dabo did.
Did you talk to him?
No, I didn't. But just in terms of, like, I was surprised, pivoting to that story a little bit, how essentially it's half and half in the playoff era of the coaches who have made the playoff. How many of them were first time head coaches at their Power Five job when they did? Ryan Day, Bob Stoops, Mark Helfrich, which is like kind of forgotten to history a little bit. Yeah.
My doppelganger.
Yeah. Jimbo at Florida State, Dabo 6 times, Lincoln Riley 3 times, Kirby Smart 2 times. The no's were D'Antonio, Chris Peterson, Brian Kelly, Nick Saban, Luke Fickell, technically, because he's a Group of Five coach and he was a year at Ohio State, and then Urban, and then Jim Harbaugh as well, and of course,
it's fine.
Coach O, who initially I wrote on the first time head coach, I completely forgot he was at Ole Miss.
How could you forget that? And USC. It's funny, the no's there might be a more impressive collection than the yeses, as far as like overall body of work and
yeah,
I mean, well, I mean, they're all good.
The Saban Meyer combo is pretty impressive.
That's good.
You know, Dabo, Kirby, eventually I would think we'll get there. You know, Stoops, his track record is very impressive. One thing that I didn't get this in the story, just I sort of ran out of space a little bit and I couldn't weave it in, but I talked to Stoops a little bit about sort of managing your staff, because he was a big, like, sort of have your family around the facility, which Marcus is that way a lot. And he's just like, yeah, I never had a staff meeting before 8:45 because I wanted to take my kids to school every day, which I did. And, you know, if we've got a family and the mom's got an appointment, you know, and the dad needs to sort of hang with the kid, come to the office, you know, can be in staff meetings, no problem. And then he's just like, everyone pretends like we're writing nuclear codes here. And so, like, it's just not that way, you know? So I think the fact that he took himself perhaps less seriously than people would have thought based on his personality back then, you know, his personality now, I mean, you and I saw him walking around with a glass of red wine, I think, in Scottsdale a couple of weeks ago. he's definitely, I think, a little bit more laid back than he ever was while he was the head coach. But I just thought it was interesting to hear how guys sort of were in various stages of, yeah, you take the job and you think you have it figured out and you don't. And only time will help you get there, which is, you know, I think that's going to be a big part of the Marcus Freeman Notre Dame story this fall, is like, where does he need time the most? Because the idea that he's just going to be sort of box ready head coach is pretty unrealistic.
I mean, nobody has figured out life as a football coach or as a post football coach better than Bob Stoops. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did seem pretty surly when he was in the heat of it, but he got out, you know, at an opportune time. And was talking to someone who worked at Oklahoma at the time recently, who basically said, like, Bob Stoops got out when he did because he knew that the program was in really good shape. And he thought Lincoln Riley had a chance to win a national championship in his first year, which he almost did. But yeah, we saw him a couple weeks ago. I was in Norman in April. He's just hanging out at practice, watching his kid play for his former defensive coordinator, Brent Venables, from when they won it all back in 2000. He did the XFL thing for a little bit, which, you know, you coach ball, you don't recruit. It seems, you know, among football coaching jobs, like a lighter lift. He's got his own tequila company. He got into the Hall of Fame this year and
coach basically, you know, I don't want to say saved Oklahoma, but like really rallied the troops when Lincoln Riley left for USC and stunned everyone in Norman. And really, I think, you know, if it was 1A, 1B between Barry Switzer and Bob Stoops, as far as, you know, Q ratings in Norman, they're on the same plane right now. I mean, that guy's just got it made. He's got it figured out. And he's only like 60 years old. I mean, he's the same age as a lot of the guys who are still in the heat of it. And is a great guy to hear from, because like you said, I mean, you've heard the stories in the past, you know, he was a family man. He didn't burn the midnight oil the way some of his peers did. And he obviously had an incredible amount of success while at Oklahoma, and is a great resource, I think, for a lot of people in the business right now. It was a, you know, really good story you wrote talking to him, Jeff Hafley, Tom Allen, Clark Lee, Shane Beamer. Clark Lee was enlightening to me as far as, you know, him getting into the depths of his poise and demeanor and how he had to wear a different hat depending on the situation for his team. Because, you know, from our experiences with him at Notre Dame, you know, you're talking about a guy who, you know, you never know whether they're coming off a 20-point loss or a 20-point win. He's just very controlled and kind of unemotional at all points. And he talked about how that kind of bit him early on when they're getting killed by an FCS team and they need more energy, they need more firepower, and he starts headbutting his team and you know, reaches their level, so to speak, emotionally. Tom Allen, I cannot believe he's naive enough, whether he's a head coach or an assistant coach or anyone associated with any opposing university, to think that his comments saying JT Barrett is not an accurate passer weren't going to blow up on him.
That was on the after the game,
which I remember going into that game. That was the first game post Kevin Wilson, who I believe just got hired as Ohio State's offense coordinator that game. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, there's a great Ohio State team. They're going to come out and win this game by, you know, 30, 40 points, whatever the line is, you know, bet Ohio State. And then Tom Allen says what he says after, which seems out of character for him. I don't know him personally, but, you know, everyone talks about him as the Ted Lasso of college football. I did not expect to see those words come out of his mouth, especially in a situation like that one. And then you get into Marcus Freeman's, you know, mistakes or errors in judgment, for lack of a better term, early on, whether it was the Players Tribune shot he took at Ohio State, you know, some of the game management stuff late in the first half against Oklahoma State, when, you know, I think head coaches, you know, their voices grow as they grow into those jobs. And, you know, we've heard coaches, you know, over a number of years at different places tell us stories to that effect of, hey, we went for this. Then we took this risk at this point in the game because we knew we were going to be without so-and-so, or we knew our defense was gassed, or whatever it is. And certainly hindsight's 20/20. You look back at that Fiesta Bowl, three timeouts and a 14-point lead. You don't think anything of it with Notre Dame to take a knee and go into the second half, or excuse me, run the ball and go into the second half with a lead. But certainly, you know, I think it's Marcus Freeman goes into a more of a head coaching role. You know, it will be on him to say, like, Tommy Reese, I know you don't think this is a high leverage situation, but you don't know what I know about this defense, and we need to score as many points as we need to right now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
That was pretty interesting to me. I liked talking to Jeff Hafley, who I think is a pretty impressive head coach who's kind of on the rise in the industry. But he talked about how, you know, the first couple of years, you know, he's a defensive guy. He's in the defensive coordinator room with Tem Lukubu pretty much all the time. Like, he's got to be in the meetings almost as if he's like the assistant defensive coordinator. And how, like, over time, you kind of have to stop doing that if you're going to be a full head coach. And now he's got enough trust in Lukubu, who was, I think, a name that was bandied about for the Notre Dame DC mm-hmm. job that went to Al Golden. But, you know, now he's able to sort of get out of those meeting rooms, recruit, manage the program, do big picture stuff, sit in meetings with John McNulty, who's now their new OC. You know, and then he's got, you know, trust in your staff was sort of a theme there, because you can't be everywhere all the time. And something's got to give in terms of your time, but also you want to build enough trust somewhere where you can give that time up. And so Halfley felt like, you know, I really have grown as a head coach that way. And I think that was probably something that Freeman struggled a little bit with the Fiesta Bowl last year, is like, you're trying to be everything. I think Freeman's point of view was like, you know, I'm going to give up the defense now to Elston, and, you know, do all this recruiting stuff, do all these meetings, be the head coach. And in some ways I feel like probably it was, I don't want to say jumping the gun, but like maybe doing that a beat too early. So I'll be interested to sort of see if he adjusts that a little bit with Al Golden running the defense this fall. If Freeman is going to be more defensive centric first and then get into the meeting rooms with Reese later in the season. And one other thing Halfley mentioned, which Freeman has echoed, is just like something as mundane as like where to stand in practice. Halfley's just like, I want to be with the DBs. I'm a DB guy. But you know, if you're a head coach, you can't just hang out with one position because you're comfortable there. You got to be all over the place so people get to know you.
Yeah, Marcus Freeman is spoken about that. I know he spoke about it at the Chicago club event I was at. And I feel like I've heard him say this, you know, multiple times in other settings. Going into practice as a defense coordinator, you want to beat the offense and win the day. That doesn't do anything for you as the head coach right now, because you've got stakes on both sides of it. It reminds me, you know, a little bit. I'm doing a kind of a follow-up story for tomorrow, hopefully, on, you know, Jimbo Fisher, Nick Saban, the whole mentor-mentee relationship and how those things always seem to fall by the wayside. As you saw, if you read our story, like that was a real thing. Jimbo Fisher was an offensive coordinator at LSU trying to win, and Nick Saban was a head coach who was a defensive guy who wanted to limit what and script what the offense could do every day. And Jimbo was always trying to prove himself. I mean, there's a long history throughout pretty much every sport of people butting heads this way. I mean, Mike Ditka, Buddy Ryan, it turned into a, I'm going to coach the offense, you coach the defense. We're not going to talk to each other. We don't like each other, but we're so damn good as a team. We're going to win anyway. And that's exactly what happened with the 85 Bears. But, you know, I keep coming back to, I feel like we've heard so many different coaches, leaders, ADs, you name it, throughout any sector, always say something to the effect of like, there's no guaranteed path to success, but there is a guaranteed way to fail. And that's to try to please everybody. And you know, that's just something that's only learned, with experience. I am curious, you know, to harp on this story. Did you by chance reach out to Dave Aranda? And I asked that because I don't know the guy, but he had a really, really rough first year at Baylor and completely turned it around in year two. And I just think that's got to be a guy with a lot of knowledge to share.
I did. The two guys that I didn't get for it that I wanted were Mel Tucker and Aranda. And Tucker, I just couldn't get it scheduled. Aranda, I reached out, didn't hear anything back. So I just like rolled with the guys that I have. But it's interesting that you mentioned sort of like the Fisher Saban dynamic and an OC trying to prove himself when he's working for a defensive coordinator or defensive head coach. And that was one thing Allen talked about and Halfley talked about. I didn't really get this in the story a lot. I didn't make the point as much as I wanted to, was the notion of your own guys, because right. Allen was just like, you know, I didn't really understand the quote unquote hit your own guys when I was an assistant, but now I totally do. And Halfley and I talked a little bit about that, and his quote was kind of interesting there, which I think fits into Freeman a little bit when it comes to Brian Mason and Al Washington and Mike Mickens and Jared Parker. He says, we were talking about, so he said, it was very important for me. This is Halfley. Very important for me to get the guys that I trusted and that would be loyal and that would treat people the right way. That would treat the players the right way. And my vision of that. So the staff came together pretty well. And then he said, I was able to do that because I've been on staffs that wasn't the case. And guys have hidden agendas. Guys, you're saying one thing and they're saying another. That was important to me, to get these people surrounding me, you know, me and the team would speak the same language and treat people the way I would expect to be treated. Like, I think Notre Dame has had some staffs over the years where they've had sort of competing agendas that I think Brian Kelly in some ways tolerated or ignored. But I think lately they haven't. I mean, I wrote a big story on the Clark Lee, Tommy Reese relationship before the Clemson game in 2020. And I think I talked to Bill Reese, Tommy's dad, who's in scouting at Notre Dame about that. He's just like, there is a 100% you can have a reality where you have a two coordinators that don't like each other and are out to screw each other, on a day-to-day basis on the practice field. And the team really suffers for that. So, you know, I think that Freeman and Reese grew to have a good relationship last year. I would think that Reese and Golden would get along just fine too. I don't know if they have any sort of shared history over the years. They're both been in the business for a long, long time. I mean, Reese played quarterback against Golden's Miami team.
Golden was almost his head coach if Brian Kelly turned the job down.
Exactly. But just how important that was. I think that's, it's kind of one of those aspects of covering college football that you never really know. It's kind of hard to drill down on that. But you certainly know it when it's gone bad. And in retrospect, I think you can look back and tell when it's good. I mean, Notre Dame won a bunch of games when it was Chip Long and Clark Lee, and they were close, but I don't think they were necessarily like-minded. But Reese and Clark certainly were, and I'll be interested to sort of see how Golden and Reese get along as well.
I feel like in some ways, not to toot our own horn, but The Athletic has kind of become a go-to place for this, where you don't realize it in real time till, you know, the season's over and you go back and talk to people and look at everything with the benefit of hindsight. But like, how many takeout pieces have been on our site of the Chicago Bears or Florida State or, you know, some team that just had a terrible year. And after the season, you do a postmortem on them and you realize this coach didn't like this coach or this coach wasn't recruiting. And this player was probably the Seattle Seahawks, right? They should have been a dynasty. In the NFL, and you know, they had a great run and they won a Super Bowl, but like, they could never get over the fact that, you know, through the defense's eyes, Russell Wilson was coddled and he cost them a chance at another Super Bowl while the defense was carrying, you know, too big of a burden, however you want to spin it. There's so many situations and stories like this. I mean, we, you know, the number of things, me and you probably heard post 2016 after Brian Van Gorder got fired and after everyone else got fired about how that season that we all thought they were a top 10 team coming into had so many blind spots. You know, it just makes sense afterward. I mean, you know, you mentioned coordinators tolerating each other. I mean, some of those early Brian Kelly staffs at Notre Dame were not exactly the most harmonious groups in the world, which made some seasons like 2012 even more of a, I mean, the more and more me and you talk to people from that 2012 team, as improbable as it was in real time, it sounds even more improbable every time we learn a new layer to that
every
season,
time Chuck Martin answers the phone, it sounds more improbable. But yeah, I think that's, yeah, it's funny. I think it was in the mailbag comments from last week or a couple of weeks ago, but I think I was joking around about, or maybe it was on Twitter, about how I've always sort of had a soft spot for an oral history on the 2007 Notre Dame UCLA game. And then somebody's
that's
like,
all yours.
I was like, somebody mentioned like, what I really want to read is an oral history on the 2016 NC State game. And I was like, you know what? That might be something interesting down the road. You weren't there for that one, right?
I stayed dry and watched that one on TV. Gladly.
For the best.
the 15 Showtimes one's one we got to do. Talk to the, because that was a really good team with a lot of great personalities who will talk and who had cameras following them like to the bathroom. I mean, it was pretty intrusive. And then 16, it all falls apart. But yeah, there's no shortage of stories like that and no shortage of people willing to talk now that all the principals are kind of off to other pastures.
That's a good point. We may be entering a target rich environment for quotes about the previous coaching staffs now. Perhaps we should take advantage of that, Malik Zaire.
There. Yeah, that's a good one. DeShone Kizer, what's he up to these days? He's still in the NFL, right?
Unclear, but yeah, I've tried to reach out to him for previous stories without any luck, but perhaps now that would change. I don't know.
The one I've tried endlessly for years, and I've had people very close to him encourage him to talk to me, and he still hasn't talked to me or anyone, is Everett Golson. just as far as like a career that like could not have started off any more promising, then takes some incredible sideways turns, then looks like it's going to be a redemption story, then kind of falls off the rails. That one to me is just like every good and bad, you know, kind of aspect of the Brian Kelly era, if you will, like he kind of lived out or embodied, you know, the highs of the highs,
really
the highs of the highs, the lowest of the lows, and everything in between. Not sure what he's doing these days, but Everett, if you're listening, give us a call.
So today was State of the Program Day on The Athletic. We've already run Clemson with Grace Landis, or Grace Landis, Grace Rayner, Ohio State with Bill Landis, and Antonio Morales, my 3-on-3 partner from the Athletic Summit, did. And if you were into Vanderbilt, Joe Rexroad, who was my other 3-on-3 partner from the Athletic Summit.
I watched all these games from the comforts of the sideline. It was like 100 degrees in Scottsdale. I took pity on everyone playing by not interviewing them or recording a podcast after, because it was pretty brutal out there.
The dominant performance from the Morales, Rexroad, Sampson trio, I'm just going to say. But Notre Dame, if you're a hardcore Notre Dame fan, I doubt that you came away like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that. But a couple interesting things to me, the opposing coach stuff, I think, is always fascinating to do and to read. That's like, I'm guilty of scrolling straight to that basically in every State of the Program that we do. The takeaways from that, very high on Buckner. This was an ACC coordinator, very high on Buckner, very high on Blake Fisher, like could not be higher on Blake Fisher. Felt he might be, he could go down as like an all time Notre Dame offensive lineman. And that, but very dubious about Logan Diggs, which was just like kind of like a, I'm not sure if I'm seeing it vibe with Diggs. You know, pointed out, what did he really do after he hurdled the guy at Virginia? We were both there to see that. I think the answer is kind of not a whole lot. Now he's got the shoulder injury. So a lot rides on Buckner, which is not that surprising. And then to get some statistical perspective on the offensive line about how bad they were in short yardage, that last year Notre Dame running backs were averaging 0.1 yards per carry before contact in short yardage situations, which is why Kyren Williams was the MVP of that team, despite the fact that, you know, he wasn't the draft pick of Kyle Hamilton, wasn't the draft pick of where Foskey or Mayer will go next year, but he was the one that bailed out that offense in so many times.
Yeah, I'm going to contradict myself a little bit here, because, you know, the Diggs comments were enlightening. And I say I'm going to contradict myself because everything you just said about Kyren Williams, I echo and agree. Like, we saw what a difference a single running back can make, both in the offense and in the locker room as a whole. But I preface with all that to say, Logan Diggs is just another guy. I don't look at that. I mean, look, it'd be better for Notre Dame if he was great, but I just think they've got enough capable bodies at that position. Like, people seem to forget Chris Tyree's on the roster, and he was pretty damn close to a five-star prospect when he came aboard in 2019. Audrey Guesstimate showed a lot of flashes down the stretch last year of what he can be. And if you've ever spent any time around the guy, he's, you know, 20 going on 40. He's incredibly mature. Jadarian Price turned a lot of heads this spring. I'm not saying expect the world of him from day one as a true freshman, but I think he's a guy that they're hoping can make a difference this year on the field. So I think when you combine those three guys, add or subtract Diggs to the mix and have what's going to be a better offensive line, they're still sorting out what that will look like. I'm just not as concerned about the run game. And here I go again, contradicting myself again. The most enlightening part from a purely statistical standpoint is when you go to the returning production. And if I were to, this was an interactive podcast, I said, anyone want to raise your hand and say who's Notre Dame's leading returning rusher?
We still need to have one of those interactive podcasts.
We do, in person, maybe in Columbus for a night game.
Ooh, absolutely.
Tyler Buckner, 336 yards. He's also obviously their leading returning passer at 298 yards, which makes up for 14% of their entire passing game last year. So, you know, you could look at those numbers, those two specifically, and think, you know, there's a lot to prove, and you wouldn't be wrong. I just also think, you know, as long as Buckner's healthy, yeah, I haven't heard any the closest thing to a criticism I've heard of the guy is he hasn't spent all that time 100% in consecutive months at Notre Dame, which, you know, is another way of saying you're a college football player and a dual threat college football player in 2022. The offensive line is going to be better. I don't think there's any question about that. And I have faith in the running backs, regardless of Diggs' status, to think that at the very least, they're going to be a much more productive unit on the ground this year.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
That was, I think, one of the interesting parts that this coach told me about the offensive line. His point of view was like, he didn't know Harry Hiestand at all, but felt like this line was going to be better anyway. Like, Hiestand will help, but felt like the biggest thing was sophomore Blake Fisher, sophomore Joe Alt. Mm-hmm. And that may make a huge difference for Notre Dame, because he's just like, he's sort of a believer in that year one to year two growth for an offensive lineman. I get it. I don't, it may be a cliche, but it's also true. So overall, you've written this, I've written this. It's so much, it sort of ties into the first time head coach discussion and story that I had last week is, you know, how much of a difference does a coach make? If you could have last year's staff on this year's team, I would tend to think that that would be a more likely college football playoff team than a first time head coach. However, if you look at this recruiting versus where recruiting was before, there is no doubt that Notre Dame has improved as a program from where it was a year ago. So it's sort of a how quickly can Marcus Freeman stop being a first-year head coach and just be a head coach?
Yeah, the final assessment part, yours, I think, trended on the longer end, because a lot of these, frankly, is just summing up everything we already read before. And then
Notre Dame has to be a referendum on everything, all times, Matt. But
it's also interesting that we're talking about a Power Five program with a mostly entirely new coaching staff, and yet we're so intimately familiar with pretty much the entire personnel on the roster. I mean, you're not reading about USC or even Oklahoma without coming away with a lot of intrigue about, oh, who's going to play at this position? I wonder if this quarterback's going to be good, et cetera, et cetera. Like Notre Dame, there's a lot less of that, to the point where it didn't even really dawn on me until I got to your final assessment part to consider, oh yeah, like, there is a different coaching staff coaching these next 12 games this year. What kind of negative or positive impact will that have? And no, I'm with you. I mean, I think whatever the Vegas over under win total ends up being probably would have been higher with Brian Kelly from a predictive standpoint, just because we know what you're going to get out of him.
Yeah.
Most years.
Like we're probably talking like a half game higher. Like
right. Not, but I'm just saying like it wouldn't be worse. Again, the coach who wins the games he's supposed to win, Notre Dame's supposed to win a lot of them, even if they're not supposed to win as many this year because of the nature of the competition. That being said, I mean, what year 13 it would have been for Brian Kelly. At some point, messages start falling flat Or it's
good point.
Or human nature kicks in, and I'm sure that part of that kicked into Brian Kelly's calculus when he decided to move on elsewhere as well. As far as like, do I just want to roll the ball out and win 10, 11, maybe 12 games again and get creamed to the playoff, or do I want to go challenge myself? I'm 60. I've got a lot of years left of me. Do I go try something new? So, you know, how does the team respond to a new coaching staff is probably the biggest question in that regard. And how does this coaching staff basically scheme their way to wins? Because Brian Kelly was really good at that when the talent was equal or lesser. I don't think there's any out scheming Ohio State or Clemson if their players are playing at their best against you on a given Saturday. So we'll see what happens, but you know, no question. The opener, Clemson, you know, it's going to be very interesting, especially at that point in the year. And then USC, which I also think given the time of the year it's at, that's obviously incredibly better roster than it was last year. I still have my question marks about them from a, you know, offensive and defensive line standpoint, and especially in the last game of the year, like you just don't know what that's going to look like.
No, I mean, it's the USC, I believe that ESPN has so many metrics. I couldn't tell you what's what, but I think one of them has them ahead of Notre Dame, but then the S&P Plus, Bill Conley's metric, has them like at 51st. So I have no idea what they're going to look like, and what they're going to look like in August is going to be totally different than what they're going to look like in November, regardless.
The Pac-12, I mean, look, Oregon ain't going to be Oregon with a new, I don't think they'll be Oregon with a new coach. I don't think Utah will be as good as they were last year, although they'll still probably be the favorites. The Pac-12 just announced like their conference championship game is going to be the two best teams, not by division. In which case, like, USC will already have their fate probably decided going into that Notre Dame game, whether they're the first or second best team in the Pac-12. There are a lot of, you know, intriguing question marks around that program. As far as we all know, they're going to be a lot better. We all know if they're not Pac-12 champions within 2 or 3 years, I'd be shocked. I think the question is, can they get there this quickly?
Right.
And if so, what's that mean for Notre Dame and what position Notre Dame is in going into that final game of the year?
We got a long off season, but thank God that we have a new coaching staff to talk about for the next 2 or 3 months, because I think that's going to carry the day quite a bit. I got a question on another podcast about somebody asked, how much does Marcus Freeman make your job harder? And I'm like, whoa. You have that exactly opposite.
Yes.
And it was in reference to like how he's recruiting so hard. He's traveling all over the place. I'm like, no. It creates this entire new library of stories to do.
The access, the additional storylines, the refreshing, you know, voices, if you will. Like, last week at the, when the Jimbo Fisher thing happened, I was at a family event over the weekend. Oh, is this a slow time of the year for you? I'm like, normally it would be. Right now it's not. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Like, for business purposes, this college football offseason, both Notre Dame and otherwise, have been freaking manna from heaven. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, from the second I walked out of the Stanford press box, like, the offseason has almost been more interesting than the season itself. I don't even know if that's an almost. Right? It is way more interesting.
It's more interesting in some ways. Like, games are like vacation, you know? Like, you go to a game, you're at a game. Like, that's pretty damn simple. I don't even worry about getting anyone on the phone on a random Monday. Like, I love it all. But the calculus is kind of flipped in that regard. It's like May, and I'm like, oh, wait, there are only so many months left to do my off-season legwork / maybe take a vacation before camp opens up in August.
Yeah. So let's set a date for a user generated podcast. We're going to do one next week post Memorial Day. I don't know what your schedule is like, but we should definitely get that
out. Works for me. There's the SEC is doing their meetings next week. I almost want to,
what's going to happen there
until after, right?
But sometime in the next couple weeks, at post Memorial Day, for sure, we will do sort of a live Q&A podcast with our listeners. So, keep an eye out for that. We will advertise, because we know it works based on our Fiesta Bowl performance. We'll advertise it a little bit more than we did last time. So hopefully we can have more listeners and we could just all sort of hang out in one happy audio family for an hour or two.
And we all know now where and what time Notre Dame's opener will be. 7:30 on ABC.
Speaking of live podcasts, it's already under discussion that me, you, Bill Landis and Ari Wasserman, who was a Ohio State beat reporter for us before he became a recruiting analyst firebrand type, but do a live podcast in Columbus on Friday night before the game. You're in for this?
I am absolutely in for this. We'll make it 2 years in a row. They're in Dublin the following year.
You're saying instead of Ari and Bill coming to South Bend and doing it, we'll actually have to do it in Dublin?
Well, me and you will do it in Dublin. Okay. It's open 2023. But yeah, they can do it in South Bend the following year as well.
Maybe we'll show up to that one.
As far as I'm concerned.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll wrap up on that for this episode of the Shamrock. Again, we'll do sort of the live podcast coming up in the next couple of weeks, post-Memorial Day. Matt, I'm sure we'll have a few more SEC exposés based on the meetings coming up for that. So keep an eye out for that if you like drama, which I know we all do. So until our next pod, he's Matt, I'm Pete. Thanks for being with us on the latest episode of The Shamrock.